From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made last Thursday night at a forum for candidates for Rochester City School Board. And here at Connections, we have tried to have a series of conversations with the candidates who are running for various offices this year. We've got elections coming up. You've heard the mayoral candidates, and we've got another round of that coming. You've heard candidates for Rochester City Council. And now we're having a chance to sit down with candidates for Rochester City School Board. As I said at the top of the hour, I think it's worth saying again, you don't have to live in the city of Rochester to want the city of Rochester to have a strong school system, to have a strong school district, to have schools that are attractive, and to have a situation where kids can succeed. And this is a chance to hear from the candidates who want to be able to do that. So this hour, a couple of candidates with us in studio. The president of the Rochester City School Board is Van White. He's back in studio. Nice to see you, Van.
Good morning, Evan. How you doing?
Very good. And it's afternoon, by the way.
Oh, it is. Okay.
It just
good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. I don't mean to correct you.
Oh, that's all right.
Also here is Dr. Cecilia Golden, who has a long resume in education, including being a teacher in the classroom. She was a principal at school number 39, was chief academic officer for the Rochester City School District, and eventually moved around a bit, came back here when, Dr. Golden?
I came back a little over 4 years ago.
And what did you find when you came? How long had you been away?
12 years.
12 years.
Yes.
And what did you find when you came back? What did you expect to find, and what did you find?
I don't know if I had any expectations because I wasn't gone. You know, this is home for me, so I was back and forth. But if there was one surprise that I did find was the condition of the city school district today and my position as an educator. That's who I am. And I just began to think about how I might be able to help.
What was the biggest glaring issue that you thought was worse than you expected?
For me, it would be the academic achievement of reading for third graders. It's very low and unacceptable.
Dangerously low, because we know how significant that is if they miss that benchmark in their future.
Absolutely.
So I want to ask both of the candidates, what we often do is just give them a chance to kind of roll out their priorities going forward. And so I'll start with Dr. Golden, and we'll stay there. I imagine that's one of the priorities. But how would you describe to voters what it is that's driven you to run for this position and what your priorities would be?
Well, it's really interesting. I was at a community meeting, and they were talking about the board seats that were open and were doing a, you know, general assessment of those who were running. And I heard them, and I kind of heard it and went on. And then we did a activity where we had to go in a concentric circle and talk about our purpose. And it was at that moment that I knew that this was what I needed to do. So it's just one of those things that I feel compelled to do because I believe I can help.
Okay. And top priority for you if you're on the school board would be what?
I think the top priority for anyone on the school board has to be to improve the academic performance of our students, academic achievement, and graduation rates.
Van White is the president of the Rochester School Board, and the community might know your name a little bit more since you've already served here. Why are you running again? Why do you want the job?
Well, I've always considered myself a servant, so it's not so much a political thing for me. It's just an opportunity to serve. That's how Sam and Anna raised me, and that's how I've continued to be as an adult. That's how I've raised my children. So for me, when I had the opportunity to figure out how I could continue to be a servant, because I was a prosecutor many years ago. And prior to that, I was a teacher. And so I, at some point in my career, after working for Bill Johnson, I thought, well, how can I continue to make a contribution to this community? And while Bill Johnson thought I was crazy for running for the school board, and he'll tell you that to this day, he thinks it was a bad career move. He understood my need for service, and for me, there was no better place to serve our community than in the school district. Because, as most folks say, including yourself, parents, citizens choose a city by and large based on the school. So, I also must tell you that I was on my own at this particular time as a lawyer. I'm a civil rights lawyer, and I was traveling back from D.C. and I got a call from my daughter, who attended Wilson High School. She was underneath a table at the time, calling me from her cell phone, saying, "Dad, there's this kid running around the school threatening to kill a teacher and others." And I felt, as a parent, so helpless. I had two kids that had gone through K through 12 through the system. So that was another reason why I ran. And I had sued the district on many occasions for lots of different things. And the reality was that kind of service wasn't producing any results, because when they come to you as a lawyer, oftentimes it's too late. And the other thing folks don't know is you can't sue a district, any district in the state of New York, for educational neglect. It just doesn't exist. And then one other thing I'll mention, you know, Dr. Golden has often said, and other candidates have said, you know, the system is not working. And I just remind people, I felt the same way. I understand why she is running, because I ran for the same reasons. Because when I decided to run for the board, the graduation rate was 39%. Only 39% of our kids graduated within 4 years. Now, we're not where we need to be, but thank God we're not where we were. We're just above 51%. But I feel Dr. Golden. I do. I understand why she's running, and I understand why all the candidates are running, and I understand why all parents are concerned about our district, because the performance is not where it needs to be. And people have to run, and that's why she's running, and that's why I'm running.
Van, how much impact does a single member of the board have on that, realistically?
I don't think individually you can accomplish much. You really have to operate as a team. And I was talking to somebody this morning, and I'm very proud to say, and I know people may not see it, they may not appreciate it, but I think we're operating well as a team now. And it wasn't so much the case a few years ago. People, were operating individually and not collectively. I think when you operate collectively as a team and you hold strong, even with some difficult decisions, I'll be straightforward with, and I know Dr. Golden knows this, everybody's been around the group, we had a difficult decision to make with respect to Dr. Vargas. But we held strong. We held together as a team. Another great example, I think Dr. Golden is right. Other candidates are right when they talk about increasing literacy for our young people. Well, there was a time, maybe within a year that I got on the board, we discovered, I put that in quotes, that we only had one reading teacher left in our district. Just one. This is obviously long after Dr. Golden had left the district. I don't know how it got that way. She probably doesn't either, because she wasn't here. But we had one literacy instructor in our district. The board got together, set up a list of priorities, and said, we want reading instructors. I think now we have over 50 reading instructors in our district. And that goes through two different superintendents. The board set an agenda, and we operated collectively and cohesively, and we got the job done. Because nothing is more important than reading. Well, as the commercial used to say, reading is fundamental.
Dr. Golden? I do know how. I may not have been living here, but I certainly heard about it, and it was through budget cuts. They cut reading teachers, they cut basic skills teachers, they changed the name, but they still cut them. So it is, you know, when we talk about that, and I'll just answer that question too about the individual on the board. It's absolutely accurate that the board, in its effectiveness, must operate as a team. However, I believe that who sits in every seat matters, and that someone has to be on the board that understands and has as their expertise pre-K through 12 as an educator, so that they can ask the right questions and understand when the right answers are given, or at least help them to get to the right answers. Right now, if I were to be elected as a school board member, I would be the only pre-K through 12, and I'll call myself expert. I am a reading specialist. I'm a bilingual reading specialist. And having have worked at central office as chief academic officer, I do understand how budgets are developed, and when budget decisions are made, the criticality of addressing the operation of reductions in a way that minimizes its impact on that classroom. Cutting reading teachers absolutely was devastating to the students in that classroom, as well as the teachers.
But Dr. Golden, you heard Van mention, you know, the board's work to try to rectify that problem. So let me ask you, I doubt you would be running if you looked at the Rochester City School Board and said, they're doing a strong enough job, they don't need me. I assume you're running because you don't feel that way. What is your chief complaint with the school board?
You know, I try to be on the positive side. I'm running because I believe I bring a level of passion and competence that needs to be on the board as it pertains to the education of students of color in particular, poor students of color, how to engage our parents. So I think about myself and the role that I would play. Not to be critical of the board as it exists right now, I just see there being a missing element. And that missing element is me.
Van, do you feel that the board needs someone with that kind of a resume? I mean, is that lacking?
Well, the reality is we're going to at least have two new members of the Board of Education. As you know, Jose Cruz, regrettably, is resigning and did not seek re-election. And, I don't want to claim the victory for him, but there's a possibility that Malik Evans might not be around. And then I'm up for re-election, and that is only because Malik, as you know, is running for city council.
Right.
And then I'm up for re-election, and Commissioner Elliott, Vice President Elliott, is up for re-election. So there's going to be at least, I think, two seats to be filled. And when you talk about those seats being filled, I think, you know, I often liken the Board of Education to a 7-cylinder engine. No engine can operate unless each of the pistons is operating effectively. And there's no one piston, one person who can address all the problems and challenges in our community. So I think it is important to have people have, separate, distinct skill sets. Right now we have a lawyer, we have a professor, we have an accountant, we have a banker, we have two human service administrators, a health researcher. I think that kind of diversity is important. I'm welcoming, because that's just going to be the reality of it, and the community should welcome the diversity, because what that allows us to do is look at things from different perspectives.
Listeners, if you want to join the program as we talk to candidates for Rochester City School Board, what are the big issues in your mind? It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Dr. Cecilia Golden and Van White are my guests for the hour. They're both running. And at the forum this past Thursday night, producer Megan Mack was there and took a lot of notes. There's a lot of passion. A lot of people had things to say. And before the candidates even spoke, there were three RCSD graduates who talked about their experiences as students in the district. One of the students explained how she felt major racial tensions between herself and her teachers, and between her teachers and her peers. Another student said she met 6 educators that were influential during her time as a student in Rochester. 5 were Black, and only 3 were technically teachers. She continued to say she didn't feel like most of her teachers were race and class conscious. And she said many didn't know how to answer questions about her own history and maybe didn't want to answer those questions. And then a third student said what children are missing more than anything are reflections of themselves. They need to see teachers who look like them. And he said it's important to have conscious teachers because we feel like we're under attack. Our children, and I was as well, my little niece and nephew are, this is quoting what he said. He said, any child of color growing up in this culture is under the most dangerous kind of warfare there is, subconscious warfare. So I want to start with you, Van. How did you receive those comments? And as a board, what can you do about that?
Well, it's difficult. It's challenging. And one of the things that I said during that forum was that the law plays a big part in this. There's this thing called first in, last in, first out. And basically that means any new hire is the first one out the door when it comes to seniority. And quite regularly and quite frequently, those new hires are people of color. So I can tell you that we have to deal with that law somehow, some way, because it is a big part of our inability to keep a diverse district. Secondly, I got to tell you, I and my son, who is also a teacher, I was a teacher. I student taught at Troy High School. I've taught in schools in Albany and in Washington, D.C., social studies, by the way. And my son, we're very rare, less than 1% of people coming out of teacher colleges are African American men. So that's the first thing. There's not a huge pool of diverse candidates, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try and we shouldn't try hard. And that also doesn't mean we've tried hard enough throughout the years. But we're doing a little bit better now. For example, I was at the leadership summit that the superintendent convened yesterday, and all but one of Barbara Dean Williams' chiefs, school chiefs, are people of color. They're either men or they're African-American women. And that's a sign at the top that things are different. Also, I got to tell you, we've had some progress in terms of recruiting and getting folks, more people of color here. Our district has increased from 2013, 2014 to 2016, 2017, the number of people of color that we hire, 36% in 2013 to 40% in 2017. And the number of new hires that are of color in 2013 was just 44%, which is a good number, but in 2017 it went up to 56%. And how is all this happening? The district is doing a better job at reaching out to historically black colleges, Morgan State, Howard, Fisk, reaching to those folks that might not otherwise think about Rochester. I also think the district is doing a better job at reaching out to groups that are engaged in this conversation, like the Take It Down group. I know the superintendent and her staff met with that group and discussed specifically concerns about hiring people of color. And let me just say, I'm like many people. This is not just a problem that's unique to Rochester. This is a problem that is nationwide. And I was one of those kids that went through the city school system and through the Brighton school system. And I can count on one hand the number of teachers of color that I had from elementary school to Georgetown Law School. There weren't many of them. And I wish I had more. And I'm hoping and praying that the kids are in those systems, young folks in those systems now, have more. But I want to add this point, that while the research says that people of color tend to connect better with children of color, the reality is, me sitting here, and I don't know about Dr. Golden, she's been through the system K through professional school, but I got to tell you, I've had plenty of teachers that were white that understood me and got me to where I am today. That's not where it should be, but while we try to diversify our staff, people should recognize that there are white teachers that can do the job for us. And let me just add one other thing, and I apologize, Dr. Golden, but let me just say this other thing. This idea of diversifying our staff isn't just for black children and brown children so they can see role models, but white children are going to live in a global economy where more and more people, most people, are not even going to look like them. So it's important that our white children also have diverse role models that look different from them.
Okay. Dr. Golden.
Wow, that was such a long response. I may have forgotten the question, but I did not. Okay, so.
I'm often accused of that as being a lawyer.
So we went into, let's begin with the reflections that those young people shared with us. It was not a surprise to me. I'm very aware of it, but it's still very painful. Young people should not have to struggle with who they are or the teachers with whom they work while they're trying to learn academically. That puts an additional stress on kids, right? So when we talk about the racial tensions that they have and the inability to connect culturally with their teachers, that to me says that there has to be a short-term as well as a long-term fix on that. So before I talk about the hiring or recruitment of teachers of color, let me talk about what we do know. There is plenty of research, which I think Van alluded to, about the effective education of children of color, regardless of the race or background of the teacher. Gloria Ladson Billings has written that book called The Dream Keepers, and Malefi Asante has also written about the effective engagement of students of color regardless of the race of the teacher. As a district, we need to have professional development around that because we understand that cultural difference does not have to mean a distance between the student and the teacher, and we have to help facilitate that as we go into strategies to recruit and hire teachers of color. And I use the word strategy on purpose. I believe that the district has to work collaboratively with the colleges and universities, as well as city government and the business community. And together, they need to not only talk about where to look and when to look for the diverse staffs that we want, but how we will incentivize them to come. And I think in the past, there have been cities that have incentivized police officers to work in the city, for example. Can we provide some type of housing, or can we provide fellowships for your graduate degrees working with the U of R, Brockport, any of the SUNY systems, Roberts Wesleyan, St. John Fisher? I don't want to leave anybody out, okay? Nazareth College. But we have to do it very strategically and intentionally. When we talk about the pipeline and we talk about the paucity or the scarceness of African-American males in the teaching force, if we look at our own graduation rates, which is around 50%, if we disaggregate, if we tease that out, we'll find like 8 to 10% of our African-American males are graduating on time. That in itself, if this is a national issue, which I know we're the we have one of the lowest in the state, if not the country. We are, by our own data, can predict a low number of African-American males in the pipeline to become teachers. This is a national issue. This is a local issue. I want us to look at it locally, and I want us to collaborate and think outside of the box in order to diversify our staffs.
And Dr. Golden, just following up, Betsy writes to the program and says, when looking at hiring more people of color, is there an issue that there aren't enough people of color that want to go into the profession of teaching because there is not enough money in it? I think if a person of color grows up in an urban environment, they get ahead, they go to college, they don't have their sights, set on achieving more than just a teacher's salary? It seems like there might be an issue there. That's from Betsy. What do you think, Dr. Golden?
That may be an issue, and absolutely there is an issue there, but there are other issues. And one of them is that the gates that students have to go through in higher ed in order to remain in education includes passing, in many cases, national teachers' exams before they can go on. We know that the passing of these standardized tests is something that many students of color have difficulty with. We absolutely have to look at that. We have to look at what are the policies that either facilitate ones going into education or serves as a prohibitor. I know that as a fact, coming from Southern University in the provost's office, that was a real issue for us. Students absolutely wanted to become teachers, but could only get so far, could not pass that test, and could not remain in education. Now, before someone says, well, do we want teachers who can't pass tests to be teachers? Let's look at what the tests are testing. Are they testing the appropriate things? We know, we have to understand, standardized tests cannot be the be-all, end-all for any type of profession, but it is very much a part of the education.
If I could just respond to that, it's been a while since I've been at SUNY at Albany, where I was in my undergraduate degree was in teaching, and I taught at Troy High School. But I got to tell you, there just wasn't a lot of. I got to agree with that caller, that person that sent in the message. There just aren't a lot of. There weren't at the time I was going. I don't know what it's not like now, but there just weren't a lot of people of color, specifically African American men, in that profession. That just wasn't the profession that they were choosing. And I think nationally, that the enrollment in teaching colleges is down. There are just not as many people seeking that profession. And there might be a number of reasons. One of them might be, in fact, money. But I can tell you this: when I was doing my student teaching, I think, again, I can count on my hand the number of men of color, maybe two digits, the number of men of color that were actually interested in teaching. But let me talk about the focus on the solutions to this. I neglected to mention, you got to grow your own population of folks. And I got to tell you, the district has done a better job. It's not the best that we can do. We've done a better job at taking paraprofessionals and moving them from that level of employment to the teaching level. For example, last year, we had 25 African Americans who went from being paraprofessionals to teachers, and we had 5 Latinos who went from the paraprofessional profession to teaching. The other thing I should mention is, sort of focusing on the homegrown population, we have a wonderful program at East High School, which I can take no credit for, but I'm sure the Delahantes and others will say that I and other board members have supported that program when maybe central office wasn't, the Rochester Teaching Learning Institute. That program began many years ago because two teachers who happened to be white decided we want to push kids into this profession. We want to hug kids through this profession. And they have done an admirable job. And I'm not going to embarrass anybody. We got people in this community, some who became teachers, some who became administrators, and some who aren't in the teaching profession that went through that program and are doing great things in this community. And then finally, it is important that the teachers that you have, the teachers that I referred to, the teachers that, you know, are teaching children of color, but they're pigment may not be so dark, white teachers would benefit. Many would benefit from professional development. And the district has moved aggressively on that front.
Professional development.
On cultural, building cultural capacity. For example, just yesterday, I was at Robert Wesleyan, and we had a packed auditorium of folks who were hearing from Dr. Joy DeGruy. She's under contract with our district, and anybody who knows anything about cultural, building cultural capacity in an institution, an agency, or any business and government will tell you Dr. DeGruy is the expert in this area, and she is under contract to help our staff better understand, whether you're black, white, green, blue, better understand the population that you're teaching and instructing.
All right. Dr. Golden, you want to respond at all to that, and then we'll take some phone calls on the subject. Go ahead.
The one thing I really want to say is that cultural competence is absolutely important, but competent teaching, understanding pedagogy, is absolutely critical. I don't want us to take our eyes so far off of one aspect of the job and go to another, because we have to know with some level of assurance that the teachers that we employ have the resources, the skills, the talents, everything they need, not just to teach our children of color, but to teach our children of color effectively, the sciences, the social studies, mathematics, learning how to read. Those are absolutely particular skills and competencies that we need to understand and know whether or not they have that. And the final thing I want to say on that, Evan, is that do we also have the proper building level leadership? Those who can provide on a daily basis instructional leadership. I think that that may be an issue that we have to look at as a district.
All right, I'm going to take one phone call on the subject. So if you've been waiting, we're going to get to all of your calls here. But Pete in Canandaigua has a specific comment to this subject. Go ahead, Pete.
Yeah, first off, thanks everybody for a great conversation. And what I'd like to bring up is the idea of trying to recruit student veterans into secondary and elementary education teaching. The number of veterans in the country that are using their post 9/11 GI Bill is increasing every year. And when you talk about a population that understands leadership, that understands cultural differences because they just come from a military that represents Americans and people from nationalities around the world and of different colors and faiths and cultural backgrounds. But as a former student veteran myself, and I went into higher education, I don't see a lot of research that's being done about, how to get student veterans into the classroom, whether that would be a good idea or not, or I don't hear a lot of that conversation. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on trying to get veterans into the classroom.
Pete, thank you very much. Van, I'll start with you.
Yeah, the law does allow, I think the title may be provisional certification, where people are allowed to temporarily enter into the classroom. There's a whole application process that you have to go through, but it's not permanent. We've done it on occasion. We have, for example, police officers, firemen and women in the classroom instructing folks. I've not heard folks talk about military folks, veterans, in the classroom, except in the context of junior ROTC or ROTC. We have a great program at Early College. Commander Ulysses Miranda is spearheading the career development of young men and women, whether they entered into career or not, every day throughout the school year, helping folks define what their future might look like. We have other ROTC programs throughout the district. Again, with instructors who have military backgrounds, they are veterans. Many of these folks are retired from service. So there is some presence, but I don't think it's to the scale that this caller is suggesting, and we ought to look at it. And finally, I would note, and again, I took some heat in this community about it, but a number of folks were talking about a military academy. I haven't given up altogether on that. This is just, as again,
where does that stand, by the way, Ben?
Well, without getting into a lot of detail, there were a lot of things that we had to get off our plate first that I wanted to make sure that we could move together as a team and as board president. We've resolved some of those things. There was some controversy and some challenges regarding expanding through a memorandum of understanding what we're doing at East High School with number 33 school. There was this, and we've got that all resolved now. That took many, many months to get that resolved. There's the idea of turning number 17 into truly a neighborhood school. That has now been resolved, and that is on the way. And then there was a lot of folks had to, the seven Pistons had to expend some energy on dealing with this without getting into a lot of the detail. There's a proposal from this group called Great Schools for All. They wanted to create sort of a community magnet breakthrough school. And so we had to deal with that and trying to figure out how we might move forward on neighborhood and community schools. The reason why I mention all those three initiatives is, again, if you're operating as a board, you don't operate singularly. You don't operate on your own. You have to come to consensus, and it takes time, and you have to work collaboratively.
Is there going to be a military school?
I can't tell you right now because I'm just one board member, and at least four board members would have to agree to it. And so what my point was, we've spent a lot of time working on those things which we came to consensus on. I haven't given up on the idea. It's up to seven board members, at least four members, to agree on it.
Do you support magnet schools?
What do you mean by magnet schools?
Well, you mentioned, and this is one of the questions from one of our listeners who wanted to know, following up on that, because you mentioned, what are your thoughts, generally speaking, on magnet schools? Great Schools for All have talked about this, creating those kind of schools.
Oh, absolutely.
Kind of changing the model.
Absolutely. I think one of the challenges that urban districts have, and this is, I was chair of the Council of Urban Boards of Education, represents thousands of urban districts throughout this country. And one of the challenges that we have is the concentration of poverty in urban districts. And there is considerable research that suggests that if you bring a balanced approach to enrollment, schools that succeed usually have a 60-40, 40-60 balance between not black and white, but socioeconomic balance. And the idea behind these magnet schools or breakthrough schools is to sort of increase the mix of people who have means and people who don't have means, black folks, white folks, Latinos. And through that mix, you will get success, is the theory. I do support creating that, just like I supported creating the East High School EPO with the University of Rochester, just like I supported the creation of the EPO at number 19 school with SUNY Geneseo. I think you have to be innovative. I think you have to look at this as a community partnership.
All right, I want to work backwards with Dr. Cecilia Golden. Do you support a military academy school?
No.
That was easy. What are your feelings on magnet schools, as we just discussed?
Magnet schools have their place, but I am much more inclined for neighborhood schools. When parent involvement has been identified as a real issue in the district, and we know there are many families that do not have a car or two cars, cannot get to the other side of town. Neighborhood schools provide families the proximity that is often needed. it also helps to build community. You can have 10 houses, 12 houses in a block, and 8 school buses show up in the morning. That is not a way in which, when I went to school, although it may have been a million years ago, we developed relationships walking back and forth to school. Our parents became friends because of the friendships we had in the community. My position is that we should invest in all of our schools, make them quality schools, make them meet measures of standards that are agreed upon, look at the communities and determine who needs more resources than another just based on the needs of the students and the community in which those schools are.
So neighborhood schools try to lift up everybody.
Yes.
Does that mean that you would do not support charter schools?
I believe that I am a believer in public education, and I understand that charter schools, for the most part, many of them, are public schools. The reality is, though, that the funds follow the children, and when that happens, it leaves absolute funding deficits in the schools from which those kids come. So in that regard, I just think we need to focus on building our general public schools better, the resources, both human and financial. I'm also I'm concerned about what may begin to be a slippery slope, these EPOs where someone else takes the schools and they do the job. And I've heard Van talk about the improvements being made at East High. And my question is, well, why couldn't we do that? Why couldn't we do that in collaboration with the U of R and others, as opposed to giving up the school totally?
Well,
that's just my
question. All right,
question.
So here's what I'm going to let Van answer that. I'm way late for a break. Our engineer's about to come through the glass and break the show himself. But I'll let Van respond, and then John, Robert, we're going to get to your phone calls. Go ahead, Van.
Okay, I can answer that. I can respond to that very simply. We are doing the job. It is misleading, and it suggests a level of misunderstanding if one concludes that the U of R is doing what the district should be doing. The U of R, by agreeing to serve as EPO, is serving as a superintendent. That's statutorily their
responsibility. That's right.
They're serving as superintendent. So it's not somebody else. It's not the U of R doing the job. And what she will learn when she gets on the board is the U of R will report to the Board of Education, just like Dr. Barbara Dean Williams does. They're no different. Let me finish. It's not just that they are superintendent, just like any other superintendent. The other thing is, when you suggest we do the job, do you know every employee that works at East High School is a district employee? They're not charter school employees. They're not otherworldly employees. They work for the district. They are hired and fired at recommendation.
What is the University of Rochester's role then, Van?
They are literally a superintendent. That's what they are. They are Barbara Dean Williams. They're the exact same thing.
Right.
So when you say, I wish we didn't have to have somebody else do it, that's not somebody else. That is the district. That's what people often don't understand.
If that works, then can that model travel throughout
Absolutely.
The district?
Absolutely.
You have the resources to do that at every school?
Evan, you've heard me say, what is happening at East High School is it's serving as an incubator of success. I give you an example. We learned that, and I don't know when this happened. I don't know if we had driver's education programs when you were at the district before you left. But do you know, last year we discovered that there was no driver's education programs being offered to city school students in anywhere in the district, not in any of the secondary high schools. But East High School, through the superintendent, the U of R, decided when they came out, hey, we're going to have driver's education courses. We were sitting in a meeting, and someone was saying, why don't our kids have driver's education courses? And Sean Nelms, who is a district employee, he's working in collaboration with the University of Rochester. He's a district employee. He says, we got it. We have it. He talked to, at that point, the deputy superintendent. The deputy superintendent said, okay, this is what you're doing. And do you know, within 2 weeks, they modeled that best practice. There's now driver's education at Edison High School.
Okay.
These are our people.
I have to ask you.
Yes.
Do you have the resources and the money to follow up and take this elsewhere?
Well, for example, let me give you another best practice. It doesn't cost money. They have at East High School what's called an upper house and a lower house. There's no financial implication. It's a division of
responsibility. So the EPO with U of R has not cost more money?
Oh, no. I'm saying there are practices that cost more money. For example, we doubled the number of social workers at East High School. We doubled the number of reading instructors at East High School. But here's what doesn't cost much more money. For example, they decided they would have an upper house and a lower house, just a division of labor, so that a principal, an associate principal, could handle those two houses. They also decided, listen, for every 10 students, every employee in our district is going to be responsible for those 10 students. Every day, every week, they meet with those 10 students. That doesn't cost this district on a dime, but that's a best practice which we're replicating. So not everything costs more money, but again, let me emphasize, these are our students at our largest high school, our employees. These aren't University of Rochester employees. This is our district, and let me repeat, the University of Rochester is our superintendent, just like Barbara Dean Williams is.
All right,
no different.
Dr. Golden, are you satisfied?
I'm confused is what I am.
I don't know why.
When you say that they're a superintendent.
Yes, that's what the law calls them.
Okay, and that the Board of Education.
Yes, that's us.
They report to you.
Absolutely.
However, why would it be a surprise to you that they had driver's ed teachers when the board would be the one that would approve that?
Well, maybe you're confused about what I said.
Yes.
I wasn't surprised that they had driver's education courses. I said that the district did not have, I was surprised the district didn't have any driver's education course throughout the district. Did you know that?
Yes.
Oh, you knew that?
Yes.
Well, I'll just have to accept that answer. I think a lot of people did not know that we did not have driver's education. I'm glad you know that, but that's why we're a 7-member board. There are some board members that know certain stuff and some board members that do not. But here's the point.
Thank you for calling me a board member.
Well, no, I said when you have a board system, you have some members who know some stuff and you have board members who not. But here's the point. What you did not know is they are a superintendent. They're just like Barbara Dean Williams. Because you said, "When I wish we had done it." That suggests to me you did not know.
She's not the only one I've heard that from.
Well, I know. I absolutely know that. But the law is, education law, section 511. It says an EPO is the superintendent. The employees that work for the EPO are district employees. There's not a single person in that building that works for the U of R. They all work for the district, including Sean Nelms.
On behalf of the community, we thank you for that explanation.
Well, I've been given that explanation quite a bit.
Okay. All right. Let me grab some phone calls.
But that's something you didn't know, right? Okay. Well, we both learned something today.
John and Henrietta. Go ahead, John.
Hi. A few years ago, I had a piece that was put in the DNC, which I was called Failure by Five, and basically decrying the fact that students are not prepared even to enter the first or second grade. And I see the abandonment of handwriting skills as being a manifestation of the genuine personal neglect of these seeds that we're trying to plant to grow into the kind of orchard we need to feed us later down the line. If students aren't prepared at the beginning, how can we expect them to develop into competent teachers at the end of the line? I'd like you to address that question.
All right, John, thank you. Dr. Golden, you're not sure exactly what he's asking?
Right.
Yeah, John, can you sort of sum up the question again? Go ahead.
Well, sure. First of all, I'm seeing that many schools are not teaching cursive writing. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is an abandonment of a basic neurological development at the beginning of our educational process. So while we're dealing with all of these systems and making students computer literate and keyboard literate, we're failing to develop the basic neurological circuitry that each individual needs to become an effective student.
All right, John, thank you. I don't think this is just about cursive. Nikki's saying it's tied to research that says there's neurological development and it's important to have kids on track, especially by five. We talked about third grade. But Dr. Golden, what do you think there?
Right. So there are a couple of things. Students coming prepared or unprepared to our schools absolutely is an issue. I never bought into and will probably never buy into this notion that kids come to school and they're not ready to learn. We are by nature learning individuals, learning human beings. And so schools have to organize and structure themselves to receive children where they are and begin with what they know and can do and work from there. Regarding the cursive writing, John, I am with you. I do not understand why or how that decision was made. We know that it helps with the synapses of the brain. We know that. And I believe that some communities will continue to teach their children to write cursively, while other communities will agree with whatever this decision was and where it came from. I think we really need to address that, Van, when we look at the primary school curricula, because it is important, and we know it is. Kids, when I was a kid and the kids in my household, learning to read the writing that parents use was an incentive. And it was also a little trick that I would use. My mother would leave me a note about washing the dishes or whatever when she went to work. And then when she came home, if they weren't done, I said, well, I couldn't read that. I wasn't telling the truth. But I, you know, kids could play with that. They knew how to, the decoding of the print as well as the decoding of cursive and the actual writing of cursive is a neurological factor that you've very eloquently stated, John. I'm in agreement with.
All right, so Van, I'm going to ask you to try to keep it a little brief.
Well, that may be a little challenging because I'm thinking back to when I was a kid and I remember those lines and the little dotted ones and you had to do the loop and it had to be in the right place. And I hear what he's saying about the dexterity that is required, the creativity that is required, the discipline that is required with cursive writing. And in fact, I've recently confronted this issue with this book that I've authored because I'll write when the parent or the kid says, will you autograph it for me? Will you sign it for me? I'll do it in cursive because that's how I came up. And then somebody said to me, you know, these little kids, they can't read cursive anymore. So I understand where he's coming from, but I will say this. That genie is out of the bottle.
We're not going back
to
cursive?
It's not that I wouldn't be willing to be a part of a dialogue about doing that, but the fact is these little guys, Palm Pilots and these cell phones, smartphones and computers that our kids are using, I think it would be very, very difficult to do that. That is an important element that our kids need, but our kids need to have comprehension. That's a skill that they need to develop.
So cursive is farther down the list for you.
In terms of priorities,
and
yeah.
Dr. Golden, sounds like you think that's given up.
Well, he thinks it's given up. I think we need to challenge it. It's not just little kids that can't read it. We've got high school graduates that cannot sign their names. They don't know what a signature is. And that is unacceptable. And that's not the case in our suburban communities.
Okay, I've got the time for to squeeze in one more question. A lot of questions about high school choice, that kind of thing. And so I'll just sum up what I'm hearing from listeners who say, you know, for example, I got a listener who emailed to say, I live in the suburbs, but I want the city to do well. Her understanding is that once you get to high school age, you can choose your high school. Is that true? Should that be the case, Van?
Well, if you're going to have a choice, and I think there should be, particularly when you come to secondary schools, there should be a choice. You got to have choices. And so when people say, oh, well, I don't know if we should have an EPO because they will be running it. First of all, again, let me repeat, we are running it. But secondly, EPOs are about choices. And thankfully, the Board of Education thus far has said, you know, we like the idea that we're creating a different type of environment so that parents will stay in our district. The number one reason I'm convinced that yellow buses come down the street or for sale signs go up is when they reach that middle school or secondary level, the charter schools are in the Catholic schools and the private schools and the suburban schools are giving them choices that the district has not given them. So when the U of R takes over a school and they report to the Board of Education with district employees, they are creating the kind of innovation, or SUNY Geneseo, by the way, that's going to
be 19. I thought you said the U of R did not take over the school.
No. They're running it. They're managing.
Okay.
The same thing. You know, Barbara Dean Williams is running our schools, right?
Got it.
All right, same thing. She's a superintendent. They're the superintendent. So when she does that, or when the U of R does that, or when SUNY Geneseo does that, they're creating the kind of innovation that keeps parents locked in, committed to this community. All we right. have to have innovation.
Dr. Golden, about 40 seconds. Go ahead.
I believe in high school choice, but I think that choice means choice, that the choice has to be quality, quality, excellence, excellence, excellence. Not choosing a school because you consider another school to be less than standard, not less than meeting a standard of excellence. And we have to do that as the district, not an EPO, regardless of what the stipulations are or are not. We need to go back. We have to figure out how was Wilson one of the top 25 schools in the country, and now it's not. We have to look at all of that.
All right. If you both get elected, will you come back here often?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely.
Good. That's the most important thing to me.
I tell you what, next time I'll come back with Sean Nelms, a district employee.
I know, Sean. Right? I understand what you're
these
saying.
These are our schools, ladies and gentlemen.
We can be
proud of these schools.
These are our conversations with candidates for Rochester City School Board. Cecilia Golden, Dr. Golden, is online. I understand there's a Supporters of Cecilia Golden Facebook page. Is that correct?
There is.
Okay. So that's where you can learn more about Dr. Golden.
Absolutely.
And her candidacy, her background, her resume. Van White, they can learn more about you where?
Anywhere they want. I'm around. I'm around.
Candidates, it's always interesting to ask that question. Van, Dr. Golden, I appreciate both of your time. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
All right, short break. Much more connections coming up.